My name is Dick Luhi. We'll be reading Genesis 1 together in the next hour. Now, when it comes to mountains and waters and summer solstice and midsummer nights, I think of Genesis 1. And when I hear a theme like something's afoot in the universe, I think of how Genesis got its start. So I'm putting my finger in at the very first page of the scriptures, and I hope you would all do the same. Our text this week will be the first 11 chapters of Genesis. It's about 9 pages in your Bible. Some people think that's going to be too much. It's called prehistory, but like all prehistory, it's written in the middle of history. After the Exodus, some of it perhaps after the first Kings, with an eye toward all that, and some of it in the Babylonian exile, where Genesis 1, our text for today, was probably composed as a kind of confession of faith, as a declaration of independence, and as a song to be sung in a strange land. And it'll be very astonishing for us, and exciting, if it should turn out the people who did that long ago should be helping us find our confession and declaration and song. Now, Jerry thinks that's possible, and he's going to help us sing about it. Tell us what, Jerry?
233.
One stanza. Now, these chapters are, especially tomorrow, but also today, are stories. And what we've been hearing at Holden in the last weeks from all kinds of storytellers is that stories are subject to a variety of reflections and imaginative responses on the part of the hearers. Right? So that some kind of lectures on Genesis or somebody's own comments, however clever, especially if they're clever, might get in the way of that. All we have to agree is to become a kind of listening community, right? Listener. That's our first agreement. Second, we need to clear the brush a little and try to read it without some preconceptions. That is to say, for the time being, it would be nice to just start reading Genesis without assuming at the outset that this is scientific history of a modern sort, though some people are going to court about that, or without assuming that it's some kind of mere myth, I mean about human beings at all times and in all places and something deep down inside them. And that way we won't get to what Elmer Witt was calling cosmogenesis, something having to do with the universe, our worship or anything outside ourselves. Let's try not to do that. Let's read it and see. Now, that is not to say that we won't get some help from historians along the way. There's a famous library in Nineveh, 640 to 620 or something like that, BC, that was destroyed in 612 and uncovered in 1932. She had all kinds of juicy materials about sort of cosmological stories in Babylon and Syria and Egypt. In some ways, it's interesting to know that that was in the air at the time when Genesis was written, if only to see how Genesis took another tack. Genesis, looking at that, said what it wanted to say by way of making its confession. So that kind of thing will help us. Also, some historians have looked at the Genesis text and have seen it kind of obviously some streams of it were written in somewhat different context. They use different language even for God, and there's a little different target of what's being said. Now, of course, it's brought together just in a row in Genesis. Now, it's worth kind of knowing that as you go along, if only to see what Genesis is up to, not just what it's saying, but what it's doing. Having said that, however, our purpose is to read it straight through. When scholars, you know, study the text, comb the text very carefully, see something that was put together by an editor in putting these pieces together to make Genesis, that person is called a redactor. They always wrote R in the margin. Well, I'm suggesting that R should be our author, the one who wrote it as it is. Augustine said translations are inspired. He even said that compositions are inspired. Let's view the text as inspired and read it as it is, but get that help that I've suggested along the way. Just as a kind of agreement, let's read it like a book and read it as it would be read by an ordinary reader, but keeping all our antennae up to see what's going on as we read. Would that be all right? I have a feeling that Genesis is a little bit hard for us sometimes because of some of the things I've said. It's very old, and it has these historical features about it. Let me, however, remind you of something that Emily Dickinson said. She said that the Bible at first the Bible seems solemn and foreboding, but after a while it seems wise and even merry. And she even said you could tell when you get a poetic passage because it takes off the top of your head. So with these kind of agreements, why don't we get started? We need somebody to read to us the first five verses. Please, we have a reader.
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, one day.
Thank you very much. Genesis really has to be read at the pace of speech. If you think that for many generations, that's exactly kind of how it was done. So we don't want to rush it, and we'll read it that way as often as we can. Now, we're in a little bit of trouble at that opening sentence, but not enough to hold us very long. In the beginning, God created. The modern translations, Jewish, Roman Catholic, and Protestant, all do it another way now. And there's even a footnote in the RSV to this effect, that opening clause, in the beginning, is really not an absolute clause, but a construct clause. And there's no article there, whatever the reasons are. A lot of them are translating it, when God began creating the heavens and the earth, darkness was upon the face of the deep, and he said, "Let there be light." If that's the right translation, and I hurry to say the Septuagint didn't do it that way, you know, the great 70 translators translated it just the way it is in here. And it's a very long sentence with which to start a book. But if that were right, then we'd have to say that there's not, in this passage at least, a clear statement of creation out of nothing. And in fact, you'd have a hard time finding that anywhere in the New Testament except in Maccabees. Though several places in the Old Testament, several places in the New Testament make this point. So that's just a kind of item of curiosity, just how that first sentence should be translated. But it invites one kind of reflection on our part. Namely, that when this is written now for the people of Israel to express their faith, cultivate their faith, it is written, so to speak, in the middle. The first creation that the people of Israel reflect on and know about is the creation of themselves as a people. The Exodus was the liberation. See, all kinds of powers are bearing down on these little people, but some of them are liberating and salvific and theological, if you like. And the first such experience for the people historically was the Exodus. Right? The first song that these people sing over the flood is not the cosmic waters, it's the Pharaoh's host drowning in the sea. And the creation of people, the first creation of people is not out of the mud. It's the creation of a people. It is he that has made us and not we ourselves. We are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand. It's out of this experience now that these people are asking, well, now what about the beginning of things? That's the first kind of thing you to reflect on. And then we have to reflect on where they're doing it. If it's true that they're in Babylon, and you know there are all kinds, as it turns out, of cosmological stories being told in Babylon. They have festivals, annual festivals, about how the world came to be. What would you do with your people who remember the Exodus but are now in a kind of chaotic state again? What would you do? Well, you sit down to tell it our way, or the way that comes from our faith. Maybe a lot more, but that's certainly included. And so you get a story that grows out of Israel's faith. And the interesting thing is not what they take out of the Babylonian air, but what they do with it when they get it to say what they want to say. In Babylonian culture, where we're sitting now, as an exiled people, slaves or whatever our status is, every year waters come over the earth, and every year they recede, and every year we celebrate a kind of cosmological festival. And the way we tell our story in Babylon is that the earth is sort of rescued from the waters. And that's frightening, because how do you know when those waters come over that they're going to go back? And so they had a long-standing story about a great monster in the waters. It's interesting how many people have a story like that. A great monster in the waters that was a great threat and a great trial until Marduk, one of their gods, comes and splits the monster and creates a kind of heaven and earth, makes a space in which to live. But it's still kind of frightening life in Babylon. What does the writer of Genesis do? For him, this monster Tiamat is just a little word to home, if that's even still the root. We're not afraid of the monster anymore. The God who led us out of Egypt handles things like this, and he'll go on to do similar things. In Babylon, the sun, the moon, and stars are all names for gods. Things above the earth, under, all have names for gods. Gods are all doing things. The world's full of little gods doing things. In the creation story, those are just going to be lamps set in the heavens. I mean, you know, the king of Babylon is reading his horoscope every day. Those are gods. Or his wife is. things up there. But Israel's taking another approach. Lamps set in the heavens. And when it comes to people, the Babylonian people are created, brought into existence by the Babylonian gods to serve them, create a lot of sacrifices, do a lot of things. As we shall see, the appearance of people in the confession and song of praise of Israel is quite different from that. So this only by way of getting at what is going on in this passage that's sharp, and that might even help us come to a confession in our own day. And we too begin in the middle, just small reflection. We sometimes say, you know, how did things begin? We all ask that question. But, you know, by tracing back causes, you're never very, very sure. You know, they had elephants standing on turtles. If you say God, that's nice, but it may just sort of stop the question for you, get rid of your headache. You haven't got a lot to say unless you cling to something you know in the middle of things. Or we can, in the modern temper, say, there's no beginning and no end that we can know about. Those are not real questions. Let's just live in terms of, that would be a modern way to do it. But in any case, we too are in the middle. And it's from there that we begin to talk about the Creator God and the cosmos. Luther says, God has made me and all creatures. As I heard a kid once say, God has made me of all creatures. Everything looked around at all things. But in any case, we too begin in the middle. And again, when we come to questions, is this just speculation or a wish, what we're talking about in terms of creation and destiny? No, we'll come again and again to the sharp experience, like that of Israel with the Exodus, so ours with Jesus Christ. And therefore, when Israel begins to go back to write its very important creation story now for the people in Babylon, it does so seriously and with discipline, but there's a little imagination in it. You have to distinguish imagination from fantasy. This is not just dreaming off, this is disciplined imagination. And similarly in the future, when the creation story is written in Babylon, already we're talking about a new creation. Second Isaiah, the later Isaiah, is writing at the same time about a new creation that God's going to do to bring us out of the chaos of this exile. And in the New Testament, we refer all the way to the creation, God will call light out of darkness, and move all the way up to the revelation, but doing the same kind of thing, talking out of an experience we have of faith here. Something like that is the situation. What the writer of the scripture is doing, we do. Only we hope faithfully and effectively, and we can learn from something like that we want to begin. All right, then, and so it begins, darkness is on the face of the deep. Spirit of God moves over the face of the waters. Huh. What can be said of creatures at this time, at this moment of brooding over the waters? Not much, except that they're somehow in that deep. Now, this is the first reference to a kind of darkness that will come again and again. When Elmer reads to us his Christian New Testament cosmogony stuff, as for example last Friday, there are some sentences in there about darkness. The darkness out of which comes this form of water. So in this moment, I don't suppose moment can be taken too temporally, the brooding spirit brings formed existence out of the formless. It says, let there be light. Now this isn't day or night. I mean, this isn't natural lightness yet, but it is to make an objective world, a knowable world. This is the light of knowing. The light that makes noise. Objects, something that can be known. And in the New Testament, we'll talk about that primal light in the face of Jesus Christ. And we will talk about those of us who love the darkness rather than the light. That's not night, daytime, simply. It's the formed existence. We have one young maverick here who likes to say, he says he likes to create chaos. Well, that works that way. But then again, we have to see this picture. And there's a little echo in there of the darkness out of which this form comes, but that darkness could always come over again, although the faith of Israel is secure now in the Creator who has established the earth. I never write this very well, but let me try to do a picture. Here's permanent. And the mountains, snow on two of them, and sea around here. This is the Earth Mountain. This doesn't seem highly imaginative to you, but let's just get behind what they're saying in the scripture. And above this is a sea, and the sea comes down around here too, around the Earth. And up here is an ocean, Earth Ocean, which comes around here, and down here's the underworld, Hades. Now, in general, that's sort of shared by the people in those days. We don't want to, make too much of this. Somebody said that the God of the Bible transcends the cosmogonies of all people, including those of the Bible. In any case, something like this, and that this is really working in the scriptures is clear. Last night we read Job, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Or the Psalms. We like Psalm 44, about the mountains shaking in the heart of the sea, the waters thereof roaring and foaming. Psalm 104 makes much of a God that could put water over the mountains. Maybe, of course, this is where you open it up and all the rain comes and all that, this opens up and spouts up, and then you've got chaos coming back in, and that'll happen before we're through with Genesis 11 and the flood. But you see the picture now, I say, why do we pay any attention to this? When every schoolgirl knows the worlds are not established on the flood, but they whirl in space, the answer would be partly to get the confession that's being made here in that context. See what they're saying about the God who has led them out of Egypt. and the future. And I would go beyond that. There's something interesting here in the sort of distance. I mean, you can get farther and farther away from life and light. In Jonah, the whale is a sort of transportation device to get him way down here. I went down to the roots of the mountains. All thy waves and thy billows. And he's trying to run away from the Lord, and it turns out it's the Lord's billows that are going over him. And he's down here at the roots of the mountain. Seaweed is around his ears, he says. There's no going back. And then, of course, he remembers the temple, and deliverance belongs to the Lord. So it's just interesting that you may have. We always talk about life ending in death. On this view, you can sort of say, are you more alive or more dead on a scale of 1 to 10? Yes?
What is the firmament?
That's the lid over the world, the sky.
And the heavens?
On this view, it's solid. It's just little windows you let the rain through. It's sort of held up by the mountains. Mm-hmm. Right? But this, I just mean, you can even start seeing our own life a little bit on the basis of this picture, if you do this progression of life. When the Old Testament says, those who honor their father and their mother will live long on the earth. They mean live well, live vitally, not be all curled up with guilt and all that stuff. Or when you say, let the king live, long live the king, you mean let him live in a vital, unified, structural way. Samson would go out and slay a bunch of Philistines, and he died. Then he would drink of the gushing fountain and live. It's kind of a back and forth thing. In city elections, they always ask, is everybody on that election list still alive? Or just like they ask of city churches, everybody on that list still alive? The answer is, yeah, but there are a lot of borderline cases. Well, we don't want to park on this. It's just to say that cosmology, there's a way of getting something out of it, even if we have another picture of the universe. And you get what's here by paying a little bit of attention to that. So, and God says, then let there be light, and we saw that makes that condition of the objective world. And he calls this, what did we read? Morning and evening. Now, that's naive, but by no means simple. I mean, this isn't the morning and evening light we've talked about, is it? It's the light of creation, the light of objectivity. The text likes to say day and night because the Babylonian have gods of night and gods of day. I'm not saying that. Yahweh, I mean the Elohim in this case. The God of Israel takes care of God of night and day. So he's making that point. But also, he might deliver us not from Babylonian gods of night and day, but say from Clock or Con Ed gods of life, of night and day. In this sense that life is not just made up of daily light and darkness. There are periods of, we live through, this is the day of our youth, and this is the day of our, the day of what I did in my 17-year-old day will not happen today, unfortunately. There are times and seasons for it. There's a season for everything under heaven. That which is given, in this case, by God from the other side of day and night is also this image. And you live with that in that kind of light and darkness as well. So there's lots of stuff to get out of here, even though we don't think of, we don't do cosmology exactly this way, and lots of stuff that we've forgotten in our own. Question is, the function of an ancient text is to help improve our eyesight in the present. Helps us see some things we don't talk about, even though we talk differently. Shall we go on? Now, or anybody want to chip something in? All right. The earth was, okay, and let there be light. Anyone? Let's then go on. The next section, it would be nice to read it. But we may come back to that. Let's just realize that the next section does 6 days, and we will read the sixth day, though the ones in between are very important. But the thing to note about them is that they're very regularly constructed, symmetrically constructed. Each section is, and God said, and so it was, and he saw it was good, and it was evening and morning. Just like that. And you have three pairs of 2 days each. First day, the luminaries. The first day is light. Fourth day, luminaries in the heaven. Second day is the earth. No, the sea and the sky. Fifth day, fish and fowl. Third day is the earth and the plants. Sixth day, animals and humans. Seventh day has no partner in the story. Seven means completeness, serenity. It's done. So it's a way of kind of being structural and about this phenomenal work of creation. It gives kind of order to it in this way. And I think we should read the sixth day. And the thing we want to watch there is that plants, that animals and people are made on the same day. Do we have a reader? Please.
And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds and the cattle according to their kinds and everything that creeps upon the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, a sixth day.
Yeah. Okay, we even got the blessing in there. We before the sixth day, we have numerically ordered things, like the stars in the sky, and sort of genetically ordered things, animals producing their own kind in a regular way. Aquinas makes the point that beavers are great architects, but they do it in the same place every year. It's a regular kind of thing. Now something different is going to happen. And you can tell because God takes counsel. Let us hang on to that. It's going to help us when we get to the question of gender. He takes counsel. He uses the word for create, bara, in Hebrew 3 times instead of some other word for made that appears elsewhere in the chapter. He speaks directly to the new creature, even uses, a mark for you twice. This is going to be a kind of speech or confrontation, face-to-face person par excellence. Something new is happening, that's clear. All right, what's happening? Well, the functional word here is image of God. Now, image of God could mean simply that God makes a creature in the image he wants for him or her. But if we say only that, then that would go for the animals as well. You make an animal in terms of the image you have for it. But if you say any more than that, you have to gasp. Because Israel does not want any images of God. And it was important for Israel not to want any images of God, because this was its great strength of having a free Lord God in the face of the empires, all of whom had kings who put their images all over. Israel's attitude toward kings is very ambivalent. We'll have to talk about that along the way. And yet, this creature is to be made in the image of God. What can that mean? Well, it can't mean the standing image of the, like the kings in the marketplace and all everywhere else. And, well, we should reflect on this, but it has to mean that the image refers not to shape, but to some kind of function, a relational image. Relational, perhaps, to himself. That's kind of a mirror and a face to. But the bearing of this creature toward that good, Dola's good that good creation, and eventually the bearing of this creature to another, to his other, is to reflect Creator. The only way I can think to illustrate this at the moment is this. I asked Elmer how he manages all this, going to the skies and the stars and all that stuff around here in Holden. And he told me, well, by getting out of the way and by appointing Ingrid and Jody a primordial couple.
Primordial couple.
Something like that is going here. You remember Da Vinci's painting of Adam on the ground and the father's finger is just kind of separating, not touching anymore. This is really a letting go of this creature who will now reflect his way of being with respect to other creatures. Let's focus on that because it's going to help us now. Even the gender question is going to help us with image of God. I like the word gender here because if you say sexuality, I think you're getting a modern word that might have some baggage we want to talk about. I don't want to talk about just yet. Notice this in verses, I think it's 27 and 28, the strange conjunction of singular and plural. Let us make man, and you know this is not a proper noun, but a common noun. You could say, let us make human, and let them have dominion. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. That interesting, almost immediate, putting of a plural alongside of a singular. Phyllis Tribble is a fine Old Testament scholar who really says that on the basis of the text, she says, and I'm not able to check this, that this first figure, this Adam, this human creature, this humus figure, this mud figure, this earth figure is sexless. And is then at the second moment becomes male and female. I guess that's sort of to make them equal. I have to remember that St. Paul, however, talked about the man being made first. Jacques Ellul takes up Paul's argument, and he says, well, that shows that the man is a little closer to the green slime than the woman. She's And he even takes up the passage that the woman is the glory of the man, which is not a favorite passage of feminists because they think of glory as sort of a decoration, like halo shampoo or your decoration. But glory means manifestation of the divine. He's making that point. So even on Paul's reading, you can do something other than subordination. But it's an interesting thing that the text itself, quite clearly, having talked about the image of God, talks about the pair. And if the image is relation, then it is realized in that relationship. The relationship of each other as one free person to another, and relationship to the world. If it's true that couples don't just stand and look into each other's eyes forever, but turn and look together at the world, as a kind of calling. And here, let's go back to that us in the divine. So, I mean, for us later ears, kind of a reflection of Trinity here. Unconfused persons in a sort of unity. Image of God. Let's talk a little bit about what freedom would mean and keep all this in mind. Freedom here on this notion of image of God would not be a quality. It would not be a problem. You couldn't cut somebody up and find his you couldn't dissect anything and find the freedom. It's not anything good. If you're not free in the sense that you're a musician or a good high jumper or a good dancer, the freedom isn't that kind of quality. It doesn't well up. What would you do to prove you're free? Goldbeard? What would you do? Freedom just... It is not equality in that sense. It has to be the nature of bearing toward other, toward others. Nature of bearing toward another free person, in which freedom itself limits itself. The nature of a bearing toward good things. And Aquinas said the great sin was to use things you ought to enjoy, or to enjoy things you ought to use. But, it's this bearing toward the creation and bearing toward woman that is the... Mark Schwain, a colleague of Mel Peel, wrote an article in the May Crescent on Jimmy Swaggart. And he said Jimmy Swaggart was never really accused of discriminating among people racially or doing things he does in Latin America or handling of finances. It's when he did something that had to do with sex, then he sinned. But the point Schwain then made with respect to Genesis 1 is that ain't about that kind of sex. I mean, that's there. That's a creation. That's there. But that isn't the only sin around. And in fact, the violation, we're not talking, this isn't moral goodness and badness. This is good. This is, I almost say aesthetic, but I just mean it is good, so it doesn't have to, we're not talking about bad behavior. We're talking about violating what is. The relationship between man and woman as image of God, or between both and the creation as good. So it's an arresting kind of thought that we get here when we talk about this creation of man and woman in the image of God. And we begin to see what would happen if the powers of darkness crept back over the edge. I don't want to press it, but it's sort of fun to just meditate on that. Now let's make two notes, and then we're all ready to talk. One has to do with the relationship of the couple, the primordial couple, or whatever many they are, to creatures. You know, the dominion over the earth, subdue the earth. I should imagine that's a thorny passage for folks at Holden. Lynn White says, if you want to find a passage for exploiting the universe, there it is. A chap named Ian McHarg, in a book called Design with Nature. If one seeks license for those who would increase radioactivity, create canals and harbors, consent to the bulldozer mentality, there could be no better injunction than this text. Lynn White Jr.'s title is The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis, and he cites Genesis. Well, the subduing, the dominion. So let's think about that. And here, my only task is to talk a little bit about what happens in the text. And there, I'd like to encourage us all to take a look at the word dominion in the biblical syntax. It refers, first of all, to the work of a shepherd, and then to the work of a shepherd king. And we should really not start thinking now about the biblical notion of king, not Tom Paine's view of king, but the biblical notion of king. This king was sworn at his inauguration to defend the poor. The blood of the poor was to be precious in his sight, partly because the rest of us get busy and forget. And it was not his job to defend the rich against the poor. Quite the opposite. It was his job to stand with the poor. Sworn to that. That was his function. Judge, give the king thy justice, O God. He was to judge the poor with the justice of God. Remember, the poor were always saying they couldn't have their day in court? That he was supposed to get it. That was the covenant. I'll tell you one other thing. The king in the Mesopotamia had an annual kingship festival when the kingship was renewed and the covenant was renewed. Now, we don't know if Israel did this, but there's plenty of evidence in the Psalms that they knew all about it. Once a year, you renewed the kingship, and you did so by marching the king out of the city gates, stripping him. Eventually he comes back in on a mule, which is a king's mount, and is robed and crowned and re-proclaimed king. But part of the ceremony was plucking hairs from his cheek and mocking him so that the king was one with the people in receiving the blows of the enemy. That the biblical people knew something about this is clear, for example, from the Royal Psalms. A lot of them have been doing that. But you spit at me, you have at my cheeks and all that stuff, and then I re-enter. But also in the story of David, the court chronicle, David at one point goes out, crosses the brook Kidron, goes up into the Mount of Olives, is taunted by people from the house of Saul. His men want to draw their sword. He says, put up your sword, maybe the Lord will see my affliction. My affliction refers to the poor of Yahweh with whom he is identified. When we say the poor of Yahweh, we include David and others like that. So the word dominion here may not mean what we're thinking. If we put it in touch, if we think of this shepherd and this king, especially if we remember that in the Palm Sunday story when they have him come in on the beast, and when at last he stands there with a crown of thorns and this robe, we would think, everybody's mind would be clicking, that's the kingship festival, but why is he suffering so much? Oh yes, we did that to the king. He's supposed to stand with the poor and the outcasts that aren't making it our side. And this, well, or how about in Second Isaiah, the very person writing at the time of Genesis, the songs of the suffering king who suffers with his people and thereby reveals a future we didn't dream about. All right, that's the only comment I can think of to mitigate that dominion subjugation thing, but it's worth saying because it's a biblical syntax. The other note I'd like to put out for our discussion has to do with language. When we say, how do people talk about God? We usually mean, how do they, where do they get any words that go for God? And they have only three choices. We have three kinds of words. Ones that are words for things that would exist even if we didn't talk about it. There may be people here who want to loosen that up a little bit, but it's distinct at least from some things that exist only if you talk about them, like fairness, justice, and so on concept. And then words about words. You haven't got anything else to talk with God about except that, so you have to use these. And when we talk about God, therefore, we always make some affirmation, and then we sort of negate it. I mean, that's sort of right, but it isn't right. And that's how we get all the modern spoof about oxymorons, how you have to use contradictory terms. And you know, the ones we make fun about. Jumbo shrimp and military intelligence. What did Tim say the other night? Adolescent culture. But if, Augustine, for example, wasn't kidding about this. When you had to say, long have I loved thee, thou ancient beauty, ever ancient, ever new. Calm delight, adore thee days, harsh and dreadful love. And you almost have to say it both ways to be taught. I mean, to get up from our language to God, that's the point I'm making. Right? If you take seriously the image of God, then wouldn't you also talk about the language coming back down? Remember, Plato had it going both ways. Once you've used it for God, it may come back and mean something different for you. Example, creativity. When the Greeks talked about creativity, they talked about our poiesis, our making things. When the Christian talks about now creation by the word, and we're made in the image of God, that might give that sense of freedom and creativity one didn't have before. In other words, we're getting our language of ourselves from God as well. It's the other way around. Why not? Or how about a word person? I don't know what the ordinary meanings for person is, but once you've worked it up and talked Trinity, well, we saw what happened when we talked about the relationship between husband and wife. You come back down. Or how about a word like grace? For creation, all the Greek would mean would be strength, kratos. And we saw what happens. Grace would probably mean a kindness, a gift. Charis is a gift to somebody. Think of the divine grace that we talk about theologically, of bearing with people, even in the face of their rejection, and now start talking about a gracious hostess, or a gracious supper in which we proleptically enjoy the feast that is to come. Our gracious invitation means a little more. When you say image of God, I just say there's some implication there for our language. Also language about ourselves. Now before we're through, I want to talk a little bit with you, not just about getting language about ourselves from God, but about getting it from the animals. But let's save that for a moment and hear what you might be thinking about what we've now said concerning a freedom that in its very nature implies limit. as the, you know, the status of human existence in the creation we're enjoying. Anybody have ideas for us at this moment?
Would you use dominion in the sense of stewardship?
Yeah, sure would. Say a little more about that. How would that mean, dominion in the status of stewardship?
Rather than a sense of subduing, but taking care of.
Responsible bearing toward, including enjoyment of. I got another picture for you. Here is, say, the Babylonian picture, where you have gods here, and gods here, and gods under the earth, and gods in the fields. And human beings, people, perform sacrifices up and down. In the biblical picture, which is sort of taken in explicit contrast to that, you have sort of God out here, remember the finger? He's not uninterested, but it's very bad to do this spatially. And what you have in here is people exercising the divine function, or the divine bearing toward things, and God keeping the finger detached even when we do some pretty desperate things. In fact, that's where you get that suffering. It's a confession of faith, you see that? And a song of praise about a God that was read out of the Exodus, Christ is bearing with us. And the song to sing in a current strange way. We like freedom. Freedom now means something special. The Imago view of freedom, and it's one that has in its center a kind of limit. And next, when we talk about the next week, tomorrow already, we get Adam and Eve, and one of the things we're going to have to say about her is she's the limit. Yes, please.
Also, in terms of how we use the land.
So yeah, you all.
If we use it in his service, say, use it for his purposes rather than other purposes as seems to fit, and also apply limits. It goes along with the stewardship.
Yes. You want to say a little more about that? I'm sure we'll be here.
Well, everything he's given us, he's given us everything. And he's also given us the command to put him first, and that we are to live our lives for him.
Who? For God?
For God, Jesus.
Sounds a little Babylonian to me.
Does it sound like Paul?
No, like the king of Babylon.
How's that?
I'm teasing a little bit, but the idea here was that the gods created people to serve them. Not quite the picture you get in Genesis. But read again the blessing. Is he telling the people what they should do for him? Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with a seed, and you shall have them for food. Every beast of the earth, every bird of the air, everything has a breath of life, I've given them food too. You should now go out there and have dominion and...
you're right. The way I did describe it, this sound Babylonian compared to this.
You're more God's agent.
But I think I think the Babylonian sound, if that's what you want to call it, sort of fits with a lot of the rest of the Bible. And maybe what you're saying is that what this looks like in Genesis, at least when you look at it separate, looks different than that.
Well, we probably should get on to reading the rest of the Bible. But at least here, if we're right, and it is speculative, that this is the dialogue part, that we're not just talking to Babylon, but we're talking to Israel in a Babylonian situation, that there is a pretty clear separation from the notion that people are created to serve the gods. It's a different kind of God we're talking about, and different kind of people. Amen. Is our confession.
He's saying pick a strawberry and enjoy, right?
Yes.
Well, when you're talking about freedom too, there's there's been people who have talked about freedom and license, and it seems to me that what we have here is we have a creation of order out of chaos, dark, whatever, disorder, chaos. And within this creation, which is ordered, all these things come out, including us. Okay, and so then we have free will, which comes later. However, if we exercise the free will to move outside of disorder, then chaos is created again. So it's this, the riddle's in the middle. There's this balance that's going on within this creation.
When that happens, what do you think we're going to talk about next in Genesis? That's a dumb question. That's not
Eve.
What am I thinking? Well, we have to see about that one. I don't want you to try to tell me what I'm thinking. But the story we're going to get in Genesis is not so much a story about Adam and Eve, once they get their names in the next chapter, lousing things up, which happens. But it's a story about what happens inside of God at that point. People are those who break their covenant, and God is His who keeps it. We're going to watch. The interesting thing about this kind of God is that He changes. At least, let's see. Let's leave that possibility open. This is a story about God.
Yeah.
If that's possible. So, thanks for your help. And, obviously, you're already pointing us to an eighth day after this good day. I'd like to kind of do that by way of closing us off today. What we get at the end of this chapter is an understanding of human beings with a great prerogative and commission and charge and permission and affirmation and a kind of limit. And this gets described now in our last little passage. Could somebody read the Sabbath passage, first two sentences of chapter 2? How about those three verses?
By the seventh day, God had finished the work He had been doing. So on the seventh day, He rested from all His work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it He rested, and all the work of creating that He had done.
Now, Sabbath, thank you. Sabbath is another confession of faith. Israel is in Babylon. It does not have its temple. It does not have the accoutrements of its religion. What should it do? Without a temple, it establishes a Sabbath. And in doing so, it's referring again to a God that is different than the one that's around in the air of in Babylon. This is a God who doesn't have to work day and night and get people sacrificing feverishly day and night. It's a God who can rest, for one thing. I mean, this is not a feverish... It's deliberately distinct from gods that are always on your back. It's also different concerning human beings. How would you like to be have a slave exile that you, at great expense, brought to your own country and you have him working for you, who says everybody should have a Sabbath? Everybody! The thing about the Sabbath is the rich get it, the poor get it. In the Haymarket dispute in Chicago, labor disputes, Jim Gorman said this when we celebrated the 100th anniversary of it not long ago, the thing that really finally snapped everybody's garter, I mean it really got them mad, was the idea that everybody should have time off. The dispute was a 40-hour week. Sabbath is for all! So it said something about the worker too. And it went beyond that. If you remember Leviticus, Sabbath is also done in terms of years. On the seventh year land lies fallow so that the poor folks that have been indentured get to work it for themselves and get a leg to stand. And I guess you all know about the 70th times seven. And I'm not going to say any more because you've got John Howard Yoder here who is not kidding about that. Ask him about that while he's here. Robert Long, Roman Catholic scholar, says it might not have been celebrated all over, but it might have been written in individual contracts. And at least one Old Testament scholar says that the horn with which you blew the seventh Sabbath is the same horn that was blown around the walls of Jericho, built by slave labor when it all came down. I just need to say that the Sabbath is a confession of faith about God, about us, and it has implications for work. Don't want to say more about that now because on Wednesday when we talk about the arts of civilization when they emerge after Cain, I think we should return to the Sabbath and talk about Sabbath and culture, because it's had a long history also in the West. But let's at least let that much be said today. And let's let this be our reflection. The permission of the blessing, it's incidentally a vegetarian permission in this case. God's going to have to change his mind about the meat that you all go to Stehegan for. The blessing is a positive, affirmative thing. And the Sabbath, which stills us, puts an end to this kind of thing. You don't just use, you also enjoy and rest. This is not a resting up for the next work. This is a rest that's all about. Great thing was to enter into this rest. Let's let that be our study at this time. And we're not talking too much about disaster yet. And I'd like to close with two modern expressions of this. Partly because some of us are still remembering Joe Sittler of blessed memory, who never got on the steam without reading some poetry, and who made the point for Christendom that grace is far too limited if it extends only to our insides and not to nature as well. What the Festschrift called the scope of grace. Your grace is too small, is what he said to us, because it covers also others. And so he would read things like E.E. Cummings. Oh, some of you know how often he said this to us. I thank you, God, for most this amazing day, for the leaping greenly spirits of the trees, and a blue true dream of sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. I mean, E.E. Cummings did not say no. But this is still, you know, this is the creation. But we have to think now of ourselves as eighth-day creatures. We're past the seventh day. And Joe would quote another poem for that. And I brought it along. I found this in the Holden Library. It's a little bit like Chief Seattle. See how close it is to Chief Seattle. Advice to a prophet. He's saying, think of your solidarity with nature, even for understanding yourself, you earth creatures. And so he tells the prophet, when you come, as you soon must, to the streets of our city, mad-eyed from stating the obvious, not proclaiming our fall, but begging us in God's name to have self-pity. Spare us all word of the weapons, their force and range, the long numbers that rocket the mind. I'll skip a little. Nor shall you scare us with talk of the death of the race. How should we dream of this place without us, the sun mere fire, the leaves untroubled about a stone look on the stone's face? Speak of the world's own change. Skip. We could believe, if you told us so, that the white-tailed deer will slip into perfect shade, grown perfectly shy. And he's gone. The lark avoid the reaches of our eye. The jack pine lose its knuckled grip on the cold edge, and every torrent burn its gliding trout, stunned in a twinkling. What should we be without the dolphin's ark, the dove's return? These things in which we have seen ourselves and spoken. Ask us, prophet, how we shall call our natures forth when that live tongue is all dispelled, that glass obscured or broken. In which we have said the rose of our love and the clean horse of our courage, in which beheld the singing locust of the soul unshelled, and all we mean or wish to mean. Ask us whether with the worldless rose our hearts shall fail us. Come demanding whether there shall be lofty or long standing, the oak tree grows.